people love shows like Law & Order SVU, Mindhunter, and Dexter that often deal with the unseemly side of everyday life. Those stories, popular as they are with audiences, are built on a dark legacy of truth, what we call true crime. While it would take a whole school of psychologists to understand why we love these stories, it takes just one good storyteller to grab your attention. M. William Phelps is just one such writer. A Connecticut native, New York Times bestselling author, and successful podcaster, he joins us today in the Municipal Voice. The Municipal Voice is the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities podcast in collaboration with WNHH LP 103.5 FM. I'm your host, Matt Ford. As always, be sure to give us a like and let us know what you're thinking in the comments. CCM's Municipal Voice podcast continues to present a key forum on important state local issues. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the consensus views of CCM or member municipal leaders. William, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Matt. Call me Matthew, if you want.
Really? You're a Matthew as well?
I am. M. William Phelps.
All right.
Matthew William Phelps.
We got two Matts here then.
Yeah.
So you have written 45 books, host an extremely popular podcast, worked on hit TV shows, and we want to get to all of this stuff. But first, I want to kind of go back a little bit.
Sure.
When did you know you were going to be a storyteller?
Oh, geez. I probably from the time I was in third, fourth grade. I mean, I just love to write.
Yeah.
You know, I love to. But what I was writing felt like it needed to be longer. You know, mm-hmm. I couldn't tell a short story in a couple of sentences.
Yeah.
I wanted to tell, you know, long stories. And then it just grew. I mean, I was always a fan of like dramatic television, you know, like mm-hmm. Bonanza, Wild Wild West with,
yeah.
And, you know, and so I wanted to do that. I wanted to tell stories. I had a mm-hmm. wild imagination.
You grew up in Connecticut and still live here. Was there
East
anything?
Starford, yeah.
Yeah. Was there anything that you could point to in being here that made you want to tell these stories?
You know, I've often thought about that. I obviously get asked that question a lot, and not really. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I like to say the day before I was a true crime author, mm-hmm. I had no idea that I was a true crime author, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't set out to be a true crime author. I set out to tell great stories of human beings, nonfiction mm-hmm. stories, real stories, and just, you know, of interesting people. And it yeah. just so happened my first book turned out to be a serial killing nurse from Northampton, Massachusetts. So yeah. you know, I got kind of labeled.
So other than your books, obviously you have written for the Connecticut Magazine, Hartford Current. Was that earlier in career, later? How did that come about?
Well, the Hartford Current and the Providence Journal and those things, I was just looking mm-hmm. to get anything I could published when I was in my late 20s, mm-hmm. early 30s, you know, and I would write op-eds. I would write about politics, sports, music, and anything I could get in,
yeah.
you know. So it was just kind of learning my chops. Mm-hmm. Connecticut Magazine came to me 4 or 5 years ago and wanted me to do a story about a true crime story about a Connecticut mm-hmm. case. So actually I did a cover story about the girls missing around the town that I lived in at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the girls I grew up with, which became the first season of Paper
crazy.
Ghost, my podcast. Yeah. I won an award for investigative journalism actually for that story. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So did you, when you knew you wanted to tell stories, did you know you wanted to be a journalist, that you wanted to do true stuff, or did you ever dabble in fiction?
Well, look, Matt, I mean, every writer sets out to write the great American novel, and you realize that you're not going to do that right away,
yeah.
right? I mean, I wanted to be, you know, the next great novelist, but mm-hmm. I understood that there's a highly unlikely chance that was going to happen.
Yeah.
And when I started talking to agents, they were like, look, if you want to write books, you know, nonfiction, you're a journalist anyway, you know, stick with that. And,
yeah.
you know, you can write novels later, which I ended up doing. So, yeah, I did want to write, I wanted to write literary fiction, which doesn't sell. You know, everybody praises you, but you sell 5,000 copies, you know, if that, you know. So, you know, I can sell 5,000 copies of a, you know, nonfiction book in a day. You know what I mean? I mean, so, yeah, I wanted to, I look, I the short answer to your set of questions here is this. I wanted to be a writer. And nothing was going to stop me from doing that. So whatever way I could get in, I got in, you know. I had to write for a living or my soul would not be complete.
So as you said, you've done the fiction, nonfiction, but a lot of what you're known for is your true crime writing. And it's a bit different than most types of storytelling because you have to engage the audience while giving the backbone of investigative journalism that, lends to the story. It's truth. How do you find the right voice when you're telling these stories?
You know, I don't know. I saw that question and I was like, you know, I don't know what the where that comes from. You know, I sit down and a lot of times, Matt, when I'm writing a nonfiction book, I don't start at the beginning. I start at the end, I start in the middle, and I just kind of find my flow and it starts to get going. But I have a particular way that I write, and that's what's going on in here. You know, so it's kind of, you know, it's kind of one of the reasons why the podcasting has worked out so well for me because the way that I write is I write for an audience. So I understand my audience. I understand the way they want the stories told, and I try to give that to them.
That's great. Another difficulty in what you do is remaining respectful to the story because unlike, Agatha Christie books or something, these are real people. How do you stay faithful to
Sure.
them?
Well, whenever I go into an investigative project, whether it's going to be a book or it's going to be a limited series podcast, you know, a long piece, the first people I contact are the victims' families. And if the victims' families don't want me to do it, I'm out. I don't do it. So I start with the victims' families and I branch out from there. If I'm going to do this, I want their blessing. I want them to be happy about it. So, because I have to be respectful to murder victims, because not everybody is. So I will be, you know. So that's what I do. I start with the victims' families.
And I think playing into that, being respectful of the families, whenever it is, there's another burden, which is on yourself, which you've written about. You had an incident that a friend called dining with the devil. A priest said was a warning. How do you handle the burden of all these stories?
Yeah, that quote you mentioned is interesting because I was beginning an interview with a very famous serial killer, and a forensic psychologist friend of mine said, you know, listen, you know, the devil knocks at your door and you invite him in to dine, you better be ready. And I kind of laughed, you know, you know, I ended up interviewing that serial killer for like 11 years. I mean, you know, so it's a tricky thing to explain. You know, when I go into an interview with a murderer or a serial killer, I'm M. William Phelps. I'm not Matthew. You know, I'm not the guy who's working in his garden or, you know, playing his guitar or whatever. I am M. William Phelps, and M. William Phelps, the only thing about him that you need to know is that he is writing this story. He is interviewing you. Everything else is off the table. So I keep it very much professional. I don't get personal at all.
These aren't people you want necessarily getting into your head.
Yeah, and sometimes they do because a psychopath is very charming, very manipulative, and they know how to do it. So you got to be, you know, you got to be as cunning as well.
So would you think of M. Williams Phelps as almost like a persona you put on when you're in this situation?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I mean, it's the brand, it's the journalist, it's the author, it's the guy on TV, you know, he's really not a lot different than me. Mm-hmm. I just don't offer any more of me than that.
There's a few times when you've, you know, done stuff other than true crime, one of which will likely resonate with a lot of listeners. You consulted on the TV show Dexter, who was a fictional serial killer known for his attention to detail. What was your role and how did your expertise translate to someone like the lead character, Dexter?
Well, what I did on that show was before the show even started to air, before the first season even started to air, they came mm-hmm. to me and asked me to construct some crime scenes for them. Mm-hmm. You know, legitimate, real crime scenes they wanted. Mm-hmm. And then they asked me to take those crime scenes and turn it into a kind of a contest that they could use in order to promote the show.
Okay.
So I commented on, you know, they would ask me questions about blood spatter and is this right? Is that right? Mm-hmm. So in general, it's a general kind of consulting over just, you know, they needed to know from an expert what an actual scene looked like when they were starting out. And, you know, I mean, there's a longer story involved there. I ended up saving
them. Was the contest for the people to figure out what the crime was, like how to solve it?
Well, this is the interesting part of it. So they come to me and they say, listen, you know, we've designed this contest where in the back of five semi tractor trailers, mm-hmm. They're going to be glassed in, and they're going to be like in Times Square, in LA, in Chicago, in Miami, in these big cities, and there's going to be a crime scene in there. And what mm-hmm. we want you to do is we want you to get five serial killers, famous serial killers, and you design the scene, and then you know who did it, and the people would come up and they'd guess who did it, and if mm-hmm. they guessed right, their name went into a box for a new car.
Real scenes, or were you creating scenes using their MOs?
Well, that's what they wanted. They wanted real scenes, and I said to them, I said, all right. So I said, so what you're going to do is you're going to put real victims of a real murder in Times Square, and you're going to have a contest about that. I said, that defines the word insensitive to victims' families. I said, how about this brilliant idea? I said, how about I create the crime scenes and I create four fictional murderers, mm-hmm. and Dexter is also one of those murderers if we're going to promote the show, you know.
One of the rooms, the scenes was actually Dexter's.
Every one of them Dexter did that. Okay. That's what it turned out to be, you know.
They were all Dexter. Okay.
And they were really all cool. Dexter, and you had to figure out how he did it. And they also did an interactive website with everything I created. So you can go online and enter the contest. But it was really interesting. What they asked me to do.
Was that your first foray into TV stuff or?
No, I had been doing TV for a while, just, you know, writing, producing, and just kind of being an expert on different shows, you know, but it was my first.
You were already kind of known as the go-to guy for crime, true crime stuff?
Yeah, I was. I was definitely one of the go-to guys for true crime at the time, yeah.
Yeah. So obviously you're most known for your books, but you've written a lot of them, but you're also taken very well to podcasting. The format's kind of seems like a natural fit for true crime stories. And in fact, many of the big hits of podcasting like Serial and S-Town are true crime stories. What drew you to the tradition of oral storytelling? Do you feel like it's different from writing a book?
Oh, it's much, much different. It's much, much harder. It's more difficult because you don't have the space that you do in a book. Coming to podcasting was just a natural order of things. I had been writing these books. I had been doing TV. I had been writing TV, producing TV. So the two things kind of came together, and then podcasting blew up and companies started coming to me, and it was just a natural fit. But it is a lot harder to tell the stories because you're telling it only with audio. So, you know, the writing needs to be, a little, you know, it's the same type of writing as I would do for a book, just a lot different, if that makes any sense. And it's a lot shorter. And so you have to get right to your point, you know, and you're using a lot more voices in a podcast than you are in a book. You know, I wouldn't quote it as much in a book as I do in the podcast.
Yeah. Do you ever start a story not knowing whether or not it's going to end up being in a book or on the podcast? Like, does the type of story kind of determine where it goes? Or is it just whatever you're working on at the time?
No, it's when I do a book or a podcast for Paper Ghosts, not for my weekly show, Crossing the Line with M. William Phelps, which is, that's a different type of podcast. It's kind of a more talky podcast. It's weekly, you know, it's a different story every week. Whereas Paper Ghosts is a limited series, you know, eight, 10 episodes.
So the
stories I choose for podcasts, I've already been investigating those for many years. I mean, I've already been deeply immersed in them, and I decide this is good for a podcast. Books also, I've already been investigating the story for a couple of years before I sit down and write a book, just to make sure that I really want to do this, you know?
Yeah, so you're gathering up and finally get to a point where you feel like you've got enough and it's relevant and it's to bring it out, to flush it out and do it.
Yeah, exactly. It's all about access for me. For a lot of people, it's not, but for me, it's about access. It's about people who are available to be interviewed. It's about the victims' families. And it's about, can I tell this story as complete as I want it to, book or podcast?
You are listening to The Municipal Voice on WNHH 103.5 FM.
Your big kind of hit podcast so far was Paper Ghosts, which premiered in August of 2020. Discussing several murders in Connecticut. What drew you to this story?
Well, what drew me to that story is I had been investigating the missing girls from Tolland County, Connecticut for 10 years before I started doing the podcast. I knew the families. One of the girls missing, Lisa White, her mother had come to me and asked me to investigate that 10 years before. She said, look, everyone's given up. I know you can do it. I knew her. I went to school with Lisa White's sister, April. Lisa White was my age. She went to the same school system I did, and she disappeared when she was 13. And so that was just the natural first case for me for Paper Ghosts. I mean, that that case defines the kind of euphemism Paper Ghosts, which is a paper ghost is a missing person poster on a telephone pole. That person has now become a paper ghost. So that case or cases defined what the show is about.
Yeah. And so you identified with that story early on because just you identified with the victim.
The victims, and I had a lot of access. I knew a lot of the detectives who had investigated the case over the years. I mean, these were guys and gals I've seen around town. Yeah. I knew all the locations. I had a lot of sources. I had a lot of inside sources, unnamed sources. Yeah. So it was just a natural thing for me to do.
Yeah. And how was it to research that? How did it feel to dig up new threads, new evidence?
Well, it feels good in the sense that I'm bringing my goal when I do this stuff a lot of times is to bring answers to the families. That's why I go to the victims' families first. And I tell them, it's likely I'm going to bring you answers. If I dig into this full time, 50, 60, 70 hours a week for a year, I'm going to find some new stuff.
Yeah.
And I want you to be prepared for that, whatever it is, you know? So how does it feel? It feels great. It feels great that I'm able to move the needle on these cases. I mean, I don't solve cases. I'm not a law enforcement. So my goal is to move the needle, is to keep it going, get it out publicly, make sure people are aware of it, dig up new information, hand that new information over to law enforcement and victims' families. And, you know, hopefully the case, you know, can get further, you know.
Are there any cases that you've helped with where your help has kind of helped solve something?
I mean, this fourth season of Paper Ghosts, which is airing now, which just won't, you know, is live right now. You know, the McDonald County Sheriff's Office in Missouri, you know, at a press conference about 3-4 weeks ago, announced the killer of one of the girls in the podcast. And they said, you know, we just want to thank M. William Phelps for his help on this and Paper Ghosts.
So that's gotta feel great. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, because of my presence, I was in the right place at the right time, and I was able to get some information that really corroborated some stuff. So, yeah, it feels great. You know, I always want to help, you know, that's my goal. I want to help.
Yeah. Can you take some of your perspective from growing up here into the story? You know, I know this town, I know these streets. Did that help you?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, whenever I do a case from Connecticut, it's always, you know, I've written a couple of books about Connecticut cases, and it always helps to, you know, grow up here, you know, and know the terrain, know the area, know what the killer is thinking. That's very important to know what this killer is thinking, be it a serial killer or a one-off, you know, to get inside their head. And, you know, when it, you know, I think the first or second episode of this season of Paper Ghosts, you know, I'm out in the Ozarks and I'm fumbling around. I don't know what the hell I'm doing out there, you know, but here I am in the middle of the Ozarks, you know, and, but I figured it out, you know, I spent enough time out there, met enough people, and I figured it out, you know, and that's part of what drives me, you know, is figuring things out. Yeah.
Yeah. So as you said, this season's set in the Ozarks, and it's ranked one of the top podcasts overall in the country right now. Is there some relief in knowing that these stories are out there for people to hear, so you don't just have them and so the victims get known?
Yeah, that's really important. I mean, with, you know, unlike a book, Paper Ghosts reach, you know, the reach is in the tens of millions of people.
Yeah.
So any one of those people could have a missing piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. And not even realize it till they hear the podcast. So that is really one of the benefits of this. You know, millions of people are downloading this show. They're listening to this story. Mm-hmm. And one of those people could be living in Alaska now, who lived in the Ozarks and left the day before the body was found, and not even know this case exists, but could have information. So that is really helpful. And, you know, I get emails, Facebook messages, social media messages every day about new cases and about the case that's running now, you know, currently. Yeah. So people are out there and they want to help, you know, and if they have information, they come forward.
Yeah. That's cool thing about like figuring some of the stuff out almost by crowdsourcing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, you know, I can wean out, you know, the stuff that doesn't really help, but people need to say it. For some reason, but it you know, you never know what nugget's going to come in to connect, or should I say link's going to come in to connect that chain together, and bang, you know, you're looking at a murderer. You're looking at justice after 30, 40 years. Yeah.
Yeah. So 9 times out of 10, it's not anything helpful, but that one time can be important enough that you have to look through them all and.
99, like, I'd say 99 out of 100.
99%. Yeah. It's being charitable.
But I don't want to stop people from sending stuff in, because everything is helpful. And, you know, it's also helpful to me to hear from people about cases, you know, they send in cases. You know, my son, you know, he fell in a river and they say he committed suicide, but I don't think he did. Can you look into it? And da, da, da. So I get a lot of that as well, you know, and I check it out, you know, I check it out. If I can help, I generally start looking into something. Matt, the thing I do is when I'm doing this stuff is if I start looking into something and I'm meeting a lot of resistance, it depends on who the resistance is from. I back away because I'm not going to get far, you know, but if I go into something and I'm moving along, and I hit resistance from certain people, then I want to dig further.
Yeah.
Because now they're hiding something. Right. So, it's a careful dance. You know, you really got to know what you're doing with this stuff. You know, it's I've just figured it out. I've learned to do it. You know, no book, no nothing. I just kind of figured it out
on the
my
job
way.
training. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Look,
I suppose there's no manual really for what you do. There's
really no manual for anything.
Yeah.
And the way I approach things is, if I want to be the best boxer, I'm not going to study a book on boxing. I'm not going to shadow box in my basement.
Yeah.
I might do those things, but at some point I need to get in the ring with Mike Tyson if he's the best boxer, and I need to go right at him, right?
Yeah.
Because he's going to teach me how to box, right? So, so you're right, on the job training. I mean, getting beat up. That's how you do this stuff. You get beat up.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you feel like you've gotten better at this over the years, like honed a lot of these things?
I hope I've gotten better, but what I have noticed is that I've learned a lot of different ways to do things, you know, how to question certain people. I've learned to, you know, when to knock on somebody's door and when not to,
yeah.
You know, when to approach a person I suspect of being a serial killer and when not to, you know, when to, you know, push law enforcement to give me information and when not to, you know,
yeah.
I mean, at this point in my career, law enforcement are now coming to me and asking if I can help, which was a goal from the beginning, because law enforcement I work with, they know I'm not going to be publicizing anything they don't want to publicize. I'm not going to be doing anything they don't want me to do. I'm there to help, and I can help. And most of them realize that.
Yeah. That brings up another point. How important is some of these collaborations to what you do? I mean, it seems like they would be absolutely necessary to gather some of this stuff.
They are. You know, you get sources, sometimes unnamed sources in law enforcement who feed you stuff because they know that it's just collecting dust,
yeah.
Right? They know it's collecting dust. No one's ever going to look at it. Here, let's give it to this guy. You didn't get it from me. Give it to this guy. He can go through it. Other times it's, you know, just people. People have stuff they don't even realize they have,
yeah.
You know, and it's, you know, I'm a documents guy. I love documents. Because documents don't lie. People lie,
yeah.
But documents don't, you know, data doesn't, you know? So that's what I'm after. Yeah.
Do you think that some of the people that you talk to about these are more likely to talk to you because you're not law enforcement?
I think that's a good point. A lot of people that I speak to have already gone through the law enforcement kind of grind, you know, and it's like, ah, they're not helping, da, 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 but you can help, you know, so they're happy to see me, you know.
Yeah.
I encourage people in with victims, families, and friends of cold cases that, because they all feel nothing's being done. And generally speaking, nothing is being done unless something is being done and something has come in.
Yeah,
I encourage, So I encourage them to, you know, you put oil on the wheel, but don't put oil on the wheel every day, because then the wheel will get, you know, really tarnished and fall off. And
yeah.
That's never good. So know when to push and when to sit back, you know, and that's very helpful to families, you know, because when I come in, they really want to help me. They really want to see me do this because no one has done nothing in so long. You know, and it's not by any fault of law enforcement because, you know, they have current cases, they have new stuff coming in, you know, so unless they have a dedicated cold case squad, like we do here in Connecticut, you don't have full-time people working on these cases, you know, they get to them when they can, you know, so it's really good for me to come along and open it all up and fresh set of eyes. I have no skin in the game.
Yeah,
I'm looking at this fresh, you know, perspective. You know, I'm not on one side or the other. I'm just looking to help to get answers here, you know? So,
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, sometimes when you hear people talking about true crime as a genre, people talk about, you know, is it exploiting people, you know, victims and stuff like that. But without, it sounds like in some cases without the interest, money, whatever that's generated by this genre, that some of these cases would just not be getting touched. Like you,
100%, 100%.
because it's your job to write these things, you have the time to dedicate to this deep, deep dive that a police officer with 30 cases might not have.
That's a great point. I mean, and I kind of just brush off the exploitive stuff because it's ad nauseum. It's just on and on and on and on. And you could say that about other genres. They're exploitive. I mean, Hollywood is exploitive for crying out loud. So, I know that what I do is in my heart. I know the integrity I have, and I know why I'm doing it. And I don't care what anybody else thinks about that. I don't care. I mean, I know that I'm out there, and you make a great point. I often tell this to families, look, if I take this on, it'll be my job 10, 12 hours a day because I'm getting paid for it. So, I'm going to need your help, and I'm going to dive in deep. And that's the benefit. And that's the benefit for them, that it is my job, right? So that's an excellent point.
So one thing we always like to ask our guests about is the future, and specifically if they're optimistic about the future. But given what you do, can you be optimistic with a job like yours? Do you
Yeah,
hope
I
that by
can.
telling these stories you're helping or something?
Yeah, I and it's part of my optimism is about this, and I talk about this a little bit on Crossing the Line with M. William Phelps. Is that I'm hoping to see the genre get some credibility back. It's you talked about exploitiveness. There's all kinds of issues going on with true crime right now that I disagree with. I don't like where it's heading. So I'm a voice to say, this is where I want it to go. So I'm optimistic about that. I'm also optimistic about helping families and being funded by, whatever, a book deal or a podcast deal or whatever, so that I can get out there and I can dig into these cases, So yeah, I'm not going to stop doing what I do based on, what some knuckleheads say from their basement, eating Cheetos and drinking Pepsi,
I think that the platforms that have given you a voice for the podcast have also given everybody else. And do you think like your background in journalism, print journalism, and books, doing that first, do you think that makes for a better podcast because you kind of had those basics of checking your sources and sort of that mentality?
Yeah, 100%. 100% it does. I mean, I'm not some hack with a computer and a microphone, who doesn't even know what they're doing and putting makeup on while talking about true crime like they do on TikTok, or just all these erroneous statements about a case before it's even, adjudicated or before someone's arrested. I know how to do this. I know what line to cross. I know, hence the name of my show, Crossing the Line. I know where I can take it, and I know where to step back. And most people don't. Most people don't, So, I mean, when I do a podcast or a book, I mean, I'm checking this stuff out up and down and sideways, and I'm going at it and making sure that it's to the best of my ability. And we all make mistakes, but this is the best that I can do, and I'm confident in that when I do something.
Are you working on a book right now?
I'm working on a bunch of different things right now. I just finished shooting a three-part series for Hulu with a company in England, based on one of my books, did some producing on that.
Is that gonna be out soon?
Well, it's the we have to deliver it in September, so I think it might be out, yeah, in the winter sweeps or something like that. And I have a number of other television projects that are, at various stages, and I do have a book that I have in mind that I want to do. I'm just not sure when to pull the trigger. And Paper Ghost season 5 is literally on my desk now as we speak. I'm going through that case now. And you know, and that's what I like. I like different things. I like to do different things, you know, work on multiple things. So yeah, I will be writing another book in the next year or so. And I know which book that will be. I just don't know when I'm going to pull the trigger on starting it. That's all. Because I want to do this other stuff. And crossing the line with M. William Phelps is, you know, that takes up a lot of my time. It's an ongoing weekly podcast, and I tell a different story each week. You know, one of the I do a lot of Connecticut-based stories. You know, I told the story of the Bumble death in Bridgeport. Two black women who were found dead on the same night. And that's, you know, so I do stories like that. I have victims' families on. We talk about these cases, you know, and so that takes up a lot of time for me. And I just, you know, I'm grateful and I'm very humbled by what I'm able to do every day. I couldn't have scripted this, and I'm very happy about what I do.
So if people want to learn more about all the products you got going on, is there a website they should go to?
Yeah, I think the mothership website is crossingtheline.biz. They can go to or mwilliamphelps.com, and you know, you can get anywhere from there.
They can find the TV stuff, the books, the
Yeah,
podcast.
everything. Yeah. And you know, just I'm at M. William Phelps. You can find me anywhere on TikTok or whatever, and you can see what I do, you know.
All right. Well, Matt, thanks so much for speaking with us today. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate you having me on, Matt.
We'd like to thank our guest, M. William Phelps. The Municipal Voice is a co-production by CCM and WNHH 103.5 FM. Christopher Gilson is our producer, Harry Draws is on the boards, and I'm Matt Ford, your host. Be sure to check out our Facebook page and give us a like, and watch out for our CCM chat series on our YouTube page.
Hi, my name is Toni Moran. I am the mayor of Mansfield, Connecticut, and I would like to invite you to join us on April 30th from 6 to 9 p.m. for a meeting of the 119K Commission, a CCM commission that is studying the problems of disconnected or at risk for disconnect children in the state of Connecticut. 119,000 kids are in this category, and there are plenty of them in Eastern Connecticut as well. Anybody who is interested in education and children is invited to join us. I hope to see you there. Thank you.